Is this fine the way it is?
Yeah, that's good. Look, you have a guitar. Yeah, let's jam. Yeah,
that's right.
That's cool. So you guys are sitting around relearning Pavement songs right now? Is that what's happening?
I was.
Sick.
Yeah. I was trying to relearn Spit on Stranger, how to do that guitar line. I'm like, Jesus Christ, man. How many? I mean, I never learned it in the past, but it's like, I'm really trying to learn it this time. And it's like you go and you do like five different things on one little line. I'm like, there's no tabs for it either. So
what?
I'm like,
how is there no tabs? That's some bullshit.
There's no tabs for that
yeah,
one.
Yeah, that's the overdubs, you know?
I know.
Yeah, it's not going to be easy for you, Scott, but you know, I know you can do it. I can run through it with you. There's more songs, too, that you have to work on.
Yeah, we go.
I've been going through this album that we're not talking about today, Bright in the Corners. I do it on YouTube, and I just go with the songs that the algorithm plays next.
Revisionist history, yeah. Matador. Revisionist history, yeah. All rights reserved. All rights reserved. It's nothing personal. It's just business. Matador. Revisionist history, yeah. Matador. Revisionist history, yeah.
Slanted and Enchanted, the rock album by Pavement, turns 30 years old this month. Matador Records is repressing Slanted and Enchanted on limited colored vinyl, as well as putting out the new massive Terror Twilight Farewell Horizontal 4LP box set, the Spit on a Stranger EP on vinyl for the first time, and much more to come this year. But today, I, Matt Sweeney, am joined by Stephen Malcolmus and Scott Camberg, a.k.a. Spiral Stairs, to look back on Slanted and Enchanted 30 years later. This was exciting for me, as that record made a big impact on me 30 years ago, and continues to kind of blow my mind. So, let's dig in, shall we?
Slanted, let's get into what we're talking about. That's right.
All right. Oh, okay. I am here with Scott and Steve from Pavement, and we get to talk about Slanted and Enchanted. And I will have you guys know that I've never read the Pavement book, and
I haven't either.
And I don't think I've ever read an interview with any of you guys. So good. Okay. So, you know, if I'm asking stuff that's been asked before, let's just imagine that there's somebody who doesn't know nothing about Pavement, but who likes rock music and they're listening. I'm trying to sort of keep it. I'm trying to keep that. That's the idea, you know? Cool.
That's a good record to start.
I mean, I'd fucking say so. I would like to say congratulations, because in my opinion, because I've been listening to it for the last couple of days, it really is like one of the fucking great rock records, which is kind of crazy. I mean, it really, really is. It holds up like a motherfucker. And not only does it hold up, but it just sort of exists on its own terms, which I think is the coolest thing that a record could do. But one, I guess I could start by saying, you know, when I put it on, my girlfriend who works at Supreme, you know, which is a skate shop that caters to young people, she's like, oh yeah, this is at least once a week listen in the shop, and it's a go-to record, and everybody always loves it. And you know, she just said all the shit where I was like, okay, these guys are going to be psyched to hear that somehow this record is like, is some sort of relevant thing, you know, and continues to be.
And it sounds young, that's for sure. You know, like I could see that, or, you know, there's something about it. My friend,
it sounds,
yeah,
go ahead.
Just my friend just went to see, I just think it's interesting what things connect with kids that are done by old guys. Cause my friend just went to see, or my drummer Jake went to see Deerhoof, you know, that band, and they're like old, but their fans were young too. What bands for? There's like young people there. I don't know why these certain things connect that way. I was like, maybe it's like Fugazi does too, probably did or something, you know, there's something timeless about it and some indie thing about it that's youthful. I don't love that term, but it, all those groups sort of have that outside of the mainstream feel that is young people like.
Right? Scott, do you have any perspective on that?
Yeah, I mean, when I listen to it, I mean, I don't think I've listened to it at all until, you know, maybe last month for the first time in a long, really, really long time.
Right.
But I guess, like Steve said, you know, it probably resonates with the younger kids because it's kind of like they're kind of. Maybe it sounds simple to them. Maybe it sounds like, you know, there's like tunes there and there's like melodies there that is kind of like, but it's kind of, there's something simple about it. And I don't know, kind of like when I went back and listened to it, I'm like, wow, these songs, I've played them so many times, mm-hmm. but like I never really... Hearing them with a fresh ears now, like so many years later, it's like, you know, that there's those tunes are there and it's kind of cool to hear.
Yeah, you get to hear it like Gary Young heard it originally, probably, Scott, you know, like our drummer yeah, was this old, relatively old to us, hippie dude. And he was like, didn't understand, you know, he would not understand why people liked the music that we made necessarily once it caught on. But he had said something similar to Scott. He's like, yeah, but you know, Malkmus has got this pop thing going on too. You know, I don't know how he does it, but you know, he's pretty great. You know, like it sort of took him a while to admit that when he saw people coming to the shows.
By the time that you came on Slanted, was he kind of getting it more on board with understanding that it was connecting or was it still
not really
because
we didn't I didn't really do pop songs. Maybe there was an EP before that called Perfect Sound Forever that was closer to Slanted Enchanted, maybe then he was
right.
So yeah, but other before that I thought he just knew it was just like a sort of piss take. And like, even though that album, Slanted Enchanted, became synonymous with this lo-fi thing that didn't really exist yet, except for, like, maybe Sebado, which
Sebado,
we didn't really know about them, but we knew that they were lo-fi, but I didn't listen to them.
Right.
Even in our minds, it was not lo-fi. That was, like, a big pop record, you know? That's, like, how
well, it doesn't
weird we were.
Right, except for that now, and this is funny... Well, I think what's fun about this record is I really don't really need to bring up other records that are like it. I was about to say that, you know, stuff like God of My Voices is just considered yeah. classic rock now, but it's the same with this. Like JR's like, yeah, you know, she's like, it's definitely a classic rock album, but it doesn't sound like old guys. But just the fact that and JR, by the way, Scott is my girlfriend, who's like, she's like in her mid 30s, but she works at, you know, for like a young men's clothing company. So she's surrounded by, you know, kind of like 17 to 25 year old kids who are all like kind of aggressive skateboarder, stylish guys, you know, just to give a context yeah. of what I'm talking about, how this music lands in the store.
They're
that
not
she works
gonna
in.
Like REM or something, probably.
No, yeah. Most shit. It's really, it's interesting what doesn't land and what does, but. Getting back to the thing, Scott, that you said about it being simple, I had a similar thought because, again, I hadn't listened to it in a while, but it's a record, you know, it's a record that I know I really, really fucking like and I listened to the shit out of when it came out. And you know, like, I feel like I know every second of the record. But going back to it, what struck me was, yeah, it lands because of how kind of poppy a lot of the songs are. They land in the simple way, but they're not fucking simple at all.
The melodies inside, basic thing is simple, but like the melodies, and it's probably the tuning Steve's using, you know, like, and you know, some of those guitar lines he's making up, you know, or really like, yeah, I think that makes it really, really different, you know? And, you know, it's otherwise it would just be kind of like, you know, Pixies or a
dinosaur record. It doesn't sound, and I mean, I think we'll get around, I know we're going to get around to that, but it's just, it exists on its own terms and it doesn't sound like Pixies. It doesn't sound like Dinosaur. It doesn't sound like any of the touchstones of what was going on at the time. But I, you know, I can still remember when I heard it for the first time and it just, it lands immediately. And I think that does have something to do with these like surprisingly, I don't know, you know, like subtle, like, I mean, really subtle, like you're getting away with a lot of proggy, clever moves without ever sounding arch or musician-y or anything like that. And that really came back around when I listen to it now, like, just like, what's the song that just starts with the chords? Bing, 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 bling, bling.
In the Mouth of the Desert.
Yeah, and it's like those chords are so fucking cool. And I remember at the time, I was like, oh, well, you know, they just kind of got it where they're fucking around and it's all just landing right. It's all just landing right. You know, I kind of thought of it as a sort of like magical confluence of things, which there's obviously, there's a certain element of that. But it's like, no, these are like really fucking cool, smart chords, you know? And like, then I thought it was just kind of almost like happy accidents, you know? And one thing that's super clear listening to it now is like this, there is like, it seems to me like a shit ton of work that was and thought that was put into these songs. But is that true? Was there?
Well, not really necessarily. Like that song, I went to Earth Day, and it was like one of the early Earth Days, like 1990 in Central Park. And this guy, Jim Coleman from Cop Shoot Cop, gave me some mescaline. Like, and I took after work, I worked at the Whitney, and I took it, and it was like a really fun to be at Earth Day. This early like environmentalism group activism thing. And then I walked back to Hoboken. Basically I took the train, but I walked all the way back to Jersey City. And that's when I heard that. So I was like playing that song with my teeth. I was just like, and I was like, that sort of sounds like the Pixies or something real basic, just those four chords without, I hadn't played it yet on the guitar. So then I got home and I was like, that's like a song, you know? So that was one of the very few songs I made up without playing guitar.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then the album, the song's called In the Mouth of Desert, and it was taken from a painting at the Whitney, which was like by this street artist named Kenny Scharf, who was like less famous than Keith Haring. And there was a painting of one of his like creatures, and then behind it was like some Grand Canyon behind in the mouth of it. So I don't know, you know. And the first guitar figure, I probably just made, I was trying to make something kind of angular and not like so catchy as the first part. And I don't know how it built into the start of the song, but somehow it did.
Like Scott, where were you, and Steve, where were you when in the time period that Slanted Enchanted got made?
Oh, I think were your parents still living there? I don't know. Were your parents still living in Stockton?
Were you in Arizona or Sacramento? Point? I don't
know. No, I was in Sacramento, I think, or Sacramento or Stockton. Anyway, I think we just got to
Christmas. I did it. I was living in New York, working Christmas at that Whitney, like hanging out at Maxwell's, you know, like being scared to go to Pier Platters and intimidated to buy a record.
I know exactly. Having grown up in New Jersey, I know exactly what you're talking about, because that was the record store that I'd go to. And I remember asking if they had some Billy Bragg record, and Bill Ryan was like, "We're not really into that." And I was like, "Oh God!" I was like, "Oh."
No, it was basically like Sonic Youth headquarters. You know, I remember they had a, for $100 you could buy a single with Thurston Moore's hair. And
oh God, I forgot about that. And then, I first heard Pavement from Tanya
Tanya was our
at Pure Platters.
She She made it so that we weren't afraid of everybody there. We eventually met the nicer people there, but initially that's what it was. We were just kind of suburban strivers that would go to Maxwell's and go to CBGB's, and Brooklyn was like too scary or something.
Oh, for sure. for sure.
And that's where I was writing the songs. I was hanging out with the Silver Jews, David, and I was trying to come up with the tunes, knowing in my mind I was going to go to Gary's studio in Stockton in the Christmas time and maybe lay some stuff down. So,
and it's post college, right?
Yeah.
Pavement's playing shows, right?
We had gone one tour, right, Scott?
I think we did two short tour.
Philly Record Exchange played in front of there. We played at Pyramid.
We did this tour with Rob, that first one. That was like five. Gary cut his leg on and couldn't play. And then I think we did the next one with Mark and Bob.
That was before Slant and Enchanted.
I'm trying to think. When did I see you at Maxwell's? Yeah. You played a show at Maxwell's, and definitely people knew what was up with Pavement, but it was still early days.
Might have been the second one was Mark in the, if Mark was in the group. Mark was a big supporter. Mark Eibold, he was in the Dust Devils, and he and one of the biggest validations was Mark's Dust Devils friends, Michael and Jackie. They liked Pavement because it was pretty intimidating to these bands like Julia Kafritz's
Pussy Galore.
Yeah, well, them, and then she had a new band after that with all these
STP, yeah, right?
Yeah, and like Helmet, Surgery, Cops, all these people turned out to be nice, but like from the outside, I mean, they were nice because we were good or we became someone vouch for us, but it was, you know, it was like being a New Jersey guy, you probably felt that.
My silence is completely agreeing. I mean, it's total agreement. It's like, and it's neat that these are all the same points. These are all the same stress points that I had, like the Maxwell stress point, you know, like the CBGB's stress point, the Pure Platters stress point, the bands, you know, and then finding out that Sean from Surgery is actually a really nice guy. Finding out that Jim Thurwell. They were scary as shit. And then finding out that Julie Capritz was actually just pretty much every bit as cool as you imagine, but she was still nice. Like,
I know.
She would just relentlessly make fun of me. And one time we actually jammed, she's like, "Wow, I don't know how you do it. Everything you play sounds like shit." It was amazing.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. It was she who was like, "I hate bass. I hate bass." You know,
we didn't have bass. Part of the reason was Pussy Galore. Well, part of the reason we didn't play bass, but we were like, that works.
Right.
And, you know, we sort of happened upon this bass amp that was a solid state. I don't know. Was it in Gary's studio or was it yours, Scott? I don't remember.
Yeah, it was Gary's casino, something casino.
Yeah, it was a little like
casino,
2 feet tall bass amp, solid state. And we played the guitar through that, so the Santa Enchanted sound to move to that is
right,
like this bass guitar through a bass amp playing the bass chords, and then like totally scratchy Stratocaster like on the right side, left and right, or you know, but we centered it.
Is the guitar detuned? Like I'm thinking of the low line on Summer Bay. Damn. Is that tuned down?
Scott plays bass on
just
that.
A D.
And that's a bass, or is
it
that
down to D? Well, bass.
I tuned it down to D, E to D, yeah.
But you're playing on a 6-string guitar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he went sick. To drop D. I don't think he ever did the CG thing, but he did the drop D.
So I want to keep on. I want to just move back before we get into that. Just like this context of like, okay, so you're done with college. You have this band. You want to keep doing this band, even though Scott doesn't live in New York, and it's not even really a band, right? Like, or it's like a recording project more.
Getting some fanzine heat though. Like, you know, Gerard Cosley said he liked it, and. You know, we made our first single ourselves, and then Drag City did the next two, and they were scheduled to do Slanted Enchanted 2.
And what was the context for you personally with Drag City? Like, they were the label that did what?
Royal Trucks.
And right,
they
okay.
were nice. Scott talked more right. to them well, about
we were supposed, fan, we being were supposed fans to be of the other first things. Single.
Right,
Scott? Yeah, because I...
We were supposed to be the first single, but then I don't think we got Demolition Plot done on time. So I think Royal Trucks was the first single.
Wow.
But we were supposed to be the first single.
That's so funny. I for some reason, I don't know why, I always think of Royal Trucks as always being slightly like the older, you know, the elders, you know what I mean? Like I think of you as children of Royal Trucks, even though it's all the same time somehow. I guess that's just because of
that first
the attitude.
Record. They made was also really great. Their self
right.
recorded one with like Andersonville on it, and they were a little bit of a presence around New York, but not seen, just sort of known to be like out of control. They were playing like at the CBGB's record canteen and stuff, but I didn't see any of those shows. I would just hear about it.
Yeah, there was a big mystique, like Twin Infinitives. I remember Jim Spring being like, all they could listen to is Twin Infinitives. And I was like at a party in the East Village. And I was like, what's Twin Infinitives? It's like Royal Trucks. I was like, oh my God, what the fuck is that? You know, like, but it was
a later one. That's when they moved to San Francisco. I was a pretty big fan. I know everything about them at the time. We were really into them. And Dan was an interesting guy. Scott talked more to Dan. I think they were like planning stuff more than I was. I mean, we had some offers from like Circuit Records that I think Surgery was on. This guy, it was like a 7-inch label called Circuit from New York.
I remember Circuit, yeah.
What else was there, Scott? Not much. Maybe Homestead sort of
there was that
talked
guy.
About it. The guy that was doing...
Who was the guy? There was a guy in England. There was a guy in England who really wanted us.
I wonder who was English guy.
Not Abbo.
Right, I know what you
not
mean.
Not Abbo, but
it wasn't
before
Southern
him.
Records, but it was somebody else. The wedding present had covered one of our songs.
John something, yeah.
That got us to notice too.
So the feeling around making Slanted Enchanted is like you really wanted to be in a part of this thing, and that Royal Trucks were gods, and you wanted to be in this mix.
I was gonna write some real songs by my mind, like catchy ones, like the songs where I also liked, you know, like Camper Van Beethoven and Velvet Underground. Like the first records, I was just afraid to do like what I thought was nerdy a little bit. So it was all like Peru Boo and the, but we obviously mixed it pretty heavily with The Fall.
Right.
Right. I decided to go full on with The Fall in a certain way. I think I really was into Dragnet, that album at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It took me a while to get, even in college, I liked The Fall. Everyone, mm-hmm. I liked their hits, what I consider their hits, which are like, Leave the Capitol. But I wasn't really, I was sort of like not the Fall fan at my school. Although they were ultimate band that you had to like, you know, I don't know what it was about the late 80s and hipsters.
They were essential. And then Scott and Steve, what was your and Steve's shared musical relationship, and what were you guys, you know, striving for / arguing about musically?
I don't know. I mean, I think I just
just listens and say that's good, that's bad. Yeah. He likes pot. Yeah. He likes pop, you know, which is good.
Yeah. Like, yeah, I always liked, you know, like I would always, Steve would have a song, you know, something that he'd be like, ah, I don't like about that, and it'd be the greatest pop song, and
yeah, he'd have be to like, try go to, for it. But I need that
come
help.
Come on, man. Let's good. Get it.
So
Summer Babe, I remember playing it for him in Gary's living room. I was just like, this is just two chords. I don't know, this is nothing. And he's like, this is cool. We're doing that one. So that's not, you know, that's important.
Yeah, okay. So the relationship was like, Steve, you're bouncing ideas off of Scott and Scott saying, yeah, you're nay and vibing. And because you and Scott have liked the same shit, is that like, why are you trusting?
Yeah, I mean, he likes the Stranglers more and Echo and the Bunnymen. And I like Echo and the Bunnymen. I mean, I had a big Echo and Bunnymen thing, but Scott was the Bunnymen guy. But he turned me on to stuff like the Replacements he knew about before me, even REM. I was like, he knew about the Alarm before me.
we must be talking high school, right?
Mm. College times. I was more a punk. I think I was a little more of a punk guy mixed with like the Doors and Creedence and Velvets. But then he knew more about the Smiths and the Cure and things that I did like. Before, because he worked at a record store. Would you say that's true?
Okay.
But he knew more about,
yeah,
like British music. I think he got me like more on. He would have known about The Fall before me, maybe too. I don't know.
And that's
not really though. I mean, you're like
college,
The Fall kind of came a little bit later when you went to UVA,
yeah,
and
I
came back.
Right.
You came back with a lot of, you know, like the Flying Nun stuff. I never would have heard.
Yeah.
Or The Fall, or even Can.
Krautrock,
I wouldn't have.
Yeah.
It would have taken me a while to hear Krautrock.
So
which
that's,
I all which I think
that's
are all
UVA. That's UVA.
Pillars
yeah,
of
stuff is,
Slanted for sure.
Right.
Like. Dino, we both like Dinosaur. I mean, that You're Living All Over Me. That's everyone has to go through that album.
I know it's funny. I feel like, I mean, that's the one, you know, I definitely date myself by sort of claiming that record as like this towering thing. And it's funny, like jumping back to like younger people, they're like, oh, they made another, like they like the stuff that's a little after that, which is crazy,
right?
My Bloody Valentine was a big one around then too, like those records with the kind of like, you know, Sonic Youth kind of guitar poppy version,
yeah,
Sonic
Youth also
guitar.
Big influence,
Well,
I had to quit school.
You quit
to go on tour.
You quit school to go on tour with Sonic Youth?
Yeah, Steve called me and said, "All right, I think it's time for you to quit school. Sonic Youth wants us. You're never going to graduate, so why don't you just like."
Like, you know, you're into all these bands, but you don't sound like any of them, you know, like, you know,
yeah,
it doesn't sound Sonic Youth-y, and it's certainly, you're not relying on like big gobs of like mind melting distortion. You know, there was something, it was funny, right before, like 15 minutes before this conversation, Brooks Headley from Superiority Burger / Born Against. I don't know if you guys know Born Against, but they were like a very vicious, vicious hardcore band. And I told him what I was about to do, and he's like, oh my god, that record. He's like, you know, there's something about that record. He's like, that's the one with the old guy playing drums, right? I was like, yeah. He's like, there's just something. He's like, in Born Against, the Adam, the songwriter of Born Against, was like super into that record. We'd listen to it every day. And there were guys in the band that didn't like it, but he was like, no, this is it. And he's like, there's something about the sound of those, of when that guy plays drums, where it's like giant, it's sort of like this giant kind of robot that's like moving. It's so funny. Like again, like how this guy, you know, like it, there's something, there really is something so striking about that, about Slanted and Enchanted. Oh, I just saw the first housefly of the year, by the way, sorry. Because
I've seen a couple already.
Oh man. But like
the first woodpecker's better. I just saw that.
Oh, nice. Very nice. What were you going to say about Gary? Because I got to ask.
Gary's drumming. Like, I mean, I think for us, we just kind of, you know, we played the songs, and hearing Gary's take on the song just elevated it to, like, you know, it was like, you know, it's just like we just had smiles, you know, like he would play so many drum beats, but it just sounded. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't like, you know, a guy playing two bass drums kind of thing, you know, like that. It was more like he'd fit in all these like notes.
Yeah. Just kind of
fit with it. I mean, it was rare that, you know, and we played live, you know, it was rare that he'd nail that. But
on
the times
him.
He did, it was,
I mean,
they were great.
When we were doing the basic takes, quite often I would, on half the songs Scott would do with, we'd all do together, and half of them I'd do just with him. And it would be like, stay on the rides, or hi-hat, go to the ride, and then like, go crazy, you know, or
right.
Like I would say, like, do your thing. But in the
right.
middle of that, there was a lot of little things that I wouldn't have, in between those rides and getting to the ride to the hi-hat, obviously he did whatever he fucking
right.
wanted. And
right.
so that was cool. So he was just playing, you know, he was just playing to a two-string guitar. You know, I mean, there's just three of us, and half the time
that
it
he
was
just
two.
that he just heard an hour
yeah,
before,
he would just
you
hear
know,
it
like,
before,
and like,
and then I
right.
would sometimes sing vocals, but a lot of it was like, come into the chorus now, and then
okay, right.
he wouldn't even know what was going to go on top of it, and maybe I didn't either, but. That keeps it sort of chaotic, and him with his, he had a mix of classic rock, being a Yes fan, and also and Emerson, Lake and Palmer, but also he had been through just playing the only gig in town, you know, for the last 20 years, which was like cover bands and punk rock. So, cause he was weird and drunk, he wasn't going to get a real job.
Right.
So he played everything in a certain way. He had been in a pretend punk band called The Fall Christianity, right? Isn't that right?
The Fall of Christianity. Yeah, they played our high school ski dance.
And he was in a false metal band called Death's Ugly Head. So he had been in lots of just bands to fuck with the teenagers, you know what I mean? Like, or play wherever with the other... In Stockton, where we're from, the lifers there's like 12 of them, were doing cool shit, and he was sort of the drummer.
When did you get in your mind that you had to be in a band with him?
He just had the studio. That was total luck. He didn't play.
Okay.
We just went there because it was cheap, and I was playing drums, and Scott was playing drums on the first single. I was just like, we're just gonna bash on things. And then he was like, I've got a drum kit, I'll play. He played on one song on the first single. And then he played not on the second one. I can't even remember if he did. But then he played. Yeah, he was just the engineer. It's the cheapest studio in town. And only one that you could go to. So that was pretty lucky.
I mean, that kind of explains, I mean, I guess that's why that record in particular sort of has the thing, because it's like there's so much lightning in a bottle stuff going on.
Yeah.
It seems to me,
we did it really quick. We did it like I think we did it in 2 or 3 days, right?
No,
and
shit,
mixed,
really?
Mixed it.
Maybe.
I think we mixed it.
I think there was
like
two
within
sessions.
A week.
I think there were two sessions of 2 or 3 days, and then the mixing.
It's a pretty astonishingly sure-footed, and I remember the first time that I heard it, I was like, whoa. This dude opens up the line with Ice Babe, which I'm assuming was talking about Vanilla Ice, right?
Yes.
And it was such a, I mean, it was such a huge moment where it's like, he just referenced Vanilla Ice, but then just made it actually feel like it means something that you know, that he's not making fun of Vanilla Ice, you know, and like that happens right away. And then the next thing is like, oh, he's like, he's not rapping, but there's this real like lyrical, confident lyrical flow that, you know, like it all hits really, really quickly and all at once. And it's probably why a lot of people say Swagger is maybe even just the first fucking 30 seconds of that song. Yeah. You know what I mean? And so did you, I was curious, did you go, was any of that stuff running through your head? Like, I'm going to fucking own Vanilla Ice. Or like, what?
I think mainly I wasn't thinking too much about it, but like,
right,
we had gotten popular reviews. And I wasn't too self, I didn't listen too closely to what I was doing back mm-hmm. then. I wasn't too self-conscious. Mm-hmm. And just those three guys in the room, I didn't really think anyone was, I don't really listen to lyrics very closely.
Oh, really?
That would be something that I was just like, is anyone really listening to this? So like,
interesting.
I take a little of that. And then, yeah, like Marky Smith being also taking influence from sort of cocky people to almost being a heel like Lou Reed or him or Alex Chilton. Sort of just being a little bit tongue in cheek. Mm-hmm. I guess that's how we got the ironic thing. But, you know, it's like... nothing ventured, nothing gained.
So right. Like, right. Well, I agree.
All a combination of all that.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense because there is another thing that I'd never done is like look up the lyrics to that record, you know, even though it's a record whose lyrics I love. But, you know, it's like there's the lines that jump out and then there's the lines that you just sort of that I just think of. I just replace, you know, with whatever line I think I'm hearing. Yeah.
There's some really good ones. The Lies and Betrayals, Fruit Colored Nails.
It's amazing.
Electricity and Lust. Like, that's really good. My wife says, like, that's so great. I'm like, I don't know what the fuck I was doing, hon. Like, I'm just, I'm glad good. It's maybe the Captain Beefheart reference when I say electricity, but other than that, I don't remember what I was doing.
Well, this is what I was wondering. So, you know, I think I've listened to it like four times the last, 36 hours. And when I was on my run, I guess I'm listening to it, I immediately thought of the thing that, you know, makes a band is how you're playing, you know, how people relate to each other and they play off of each other. And, you know, like, and we touched on how you'd run things by Scott, but so now would be the right time to bring up Berman, because the thought that I had was like these lyrics are so, and I remember really at the time the lyrics jumped out, like they were smart in this really neat way. And when I look back on it now, I guess I was just wondering, was Steve trying to blow Berman's mind ever? Were you thinking about yeah. David? Like this dick is going to hear these lyrics and he's going to hold me to task. And he's obviously really smart and he's had a big influence on me. And so I got to have to fucking hit him with this shit.
Done much yet. I think I was still like the older brother that was doing shit then. And he was doing his poetry, but I didn't necessarily think he was going to do music lyrics, but I would have been like, we hung out in the Whitney and like we're writing stuff and like I knew he was like super clever and like I'd be looking for a vouch of anything I thought was good in my journal would be like, I would definitely think I would want it to him to like it or whatever.
Right.
That.
Right.
But like, as far as the music goes though, again, we were both, all of us were like, there was the Whitney Museum and some of the postmodern philosophies that were like in there in terms of art making,
like
Richard Prince and
some
like less famous people. There was a lot of theory art like Derrida and Baudrillard and these things, and then mixed with some also recent art, post-minimalist, which wasn't really about philosophy and semantics, but just that kind of art that were running there that made us think, and me think, like, you can do it. You can kind of spin anything. Sorry to be a long one. You can like
sort
of a justification for anything you're doing. You know, as long as you have like the kind of bullshit to back it up.
right. Well,
like,
yeah,
you know, it's, anything's valid. You don't have to be like a really good, I mean, it's down to like being a really good singer, having like in tune or great technique or something, you know, like that's over with, you know, like that's already
right.
Done. So it's time for something new, that kind of thing. That all played, that really was useful. And that was useful to go to New York and be in that environment.
Yeah. I thought that I had, well, I'm definitely gonna want to bounce back to Berman for a second, a little bit more about words, but a thought that I had also was like, and I remember at the time, I was like, wait, the cult Pavement? There was something almost like last level, like dumb / smart about, you know, it's like, really? Bands are just calling, bands are calling themselves like Pavement? Like what? You know, but that sort of opened up a different, for sure, opened up a different way of thinking that I think kind of goes through to what you're talking about. It goes through these records, which is like, when I was on my run, I was like, so is Pavement like the first sort of like post everything band? Are they sort of setting up the internet, you know, in a weird way? You know what I mean? But, you know, but the idea that like, the idea that lots more can fly within this indie rock thing, like a lot of stuff can fly, you know what I mean? Like, like a lot of stuff can happen. And also like, and Slain and Enchanted definitely has this feeling of like, it's cool that you mentioned that you did Mescaline. There is some sort of sense of like seeing things a new way. Even, I mean, you know, even the name Slanted and Enchanted is like, it's such a great title because it has this idea.
David made up that title. I was like, that's great. We're using that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I agree with you. Within a rock context, definitely. I mean, that's our thing. We are kind of within a context of, because we are just like rock fans. Like, music's gone on farther to do, obviously, more things, queer music, disco, and, like, we don't really touch that, but within our, like, paradigm breaking, we are within that, within, like, because, like, I am, in the end, I'm a rock god, like, worshiper of fucking Jimmy Page and the Stones, like, at heart. Even with all this post shit, you know, so that's where I come. That's where we come from, is like fucking with those things. Classic rock tropes and everything.
Totally. I mean, cause when, so, jumping back to Pure Platters, you know, so you go to what's known as the coolest record store in Hoboken, and for listeners, for context, like the incredibly stylish and like smokingly good looking woman who worked there, did the first Nirvana 7-inch, you know, did the artwork for the first Nirvana 7-inch, just to give a context of like how fucking cool this place was. And so I go in there, I hear some trebly sounding weird shit on the stereo, and it's Tanya. I'm like, what is this? She goes, this is the best band. This is Pavement. They fucking rule. They're the fucking best. And I was like, and so immediately, because Tanya was cool,
you're like, fuck
because
the shit.
Yeah, I was like, fuck this shit, you know. But then I went to see you guys play at Maxwell's, and talking about the rock stuff, I was like, fucking goddamn, like the guitar playing was ferocious, you know what I mean? And like it was really, it was such a, like what really hit me was the guitar action and also the drum action. And it was, again, I was expecting, you know, I don't know, I was going to see the Unsane, I was going to see the Unsane, you know, all the bands, no bands could play well at the time, or if they did, that was the shtick, is that they played well, you know, like this was this thing where it was like, wait, these records sound one way, but live, they really, like, it's crazy how good this is, you know?
It must have been one good show. That's nice to hear.
It had to be. it really had to be. And just another point.
We did have a couple good ones. We were very patchy, though.
Yeah, no, I know. But this one fucking slayed. And I was really unprepared for how good it was. I was like, fuck, God damn it. All right. You know, like reconfigure everything. And I'm walking out, feeling really good about it, you know, and some fucking older guy says, huh, I didn't think it was possible that a band could just rip off The Fall, but here we go. like that's what this fucking guy said. And just like overhearing that, I was like, God, I hate older people. They're so fucking annoying. Like I don't, you know, I knew who The Fall was, but like I was like enjoying this moment of like, oh wow. You know, like I like good guitar playing. This is good guitar playing. This is like Dinosaur in that way, where this is fresh, but there's obviously all this. There's this classic, or I mean, I don't even call it classic rock. There's this rock thing that's going on that's totally undeniable. And there's intent, and there's fire, and there's fucking, you know, like that. You know, that's this thing. Yeah. And then I'm thinking all this stuff, and then this fucking guy's like, hey, they just ripped off The Fall. You know, it's like.
We wouldn't really know completely how. We just had very slight signifiers of them, like two songs. I would say, you know, he's right if you listen to the album on like.
Yeah, but no. I mean, yeah.
The rest are just influenced by them.
Yeah, I mean, but again, it's great. Well, like, so what you're talking like Two States?
Two States and, well, New Face in Hell. Conduit for Sale is very similar to the song New Face in Hell. But that's all right, you know, it's like,
no, I mean, I'm,
the rest are just influenced. There's a couple more that are definitely influenced by them, but then it goes a lot of other places, luckily. Otherwise we wouldn't be here talking about it, I don't think,
for sure. I mean and then, and also what was I mean, it's funny because then it did, I immediately got into The Fall after enjoying Pavement, because because I was like, oh, I see, there's a lot of stuff, but then again, what came back to me was more like, oh, The Fall is such a great way of looking at the world, you know, just like Pavement's a great way of looking at the world, you know, but what specifically hit you with like what did you take from The Fall that, and you know,
The minimalism of the, first of all, like, you maybe don't necessarily need a chorus, like, basically, it can go
repetition.
Over and over.
Repetition, right.
And, which the Pixies always did that too, but I started to think that you can just play the same chords and sing something over it differently. That can be the chorus.
I
would have been more like, it's got to be like Rock and Roll by the Velvet Underground, or everything's gonna have some parts.
It's okay,
go to a chorus, or the Beatles or something. So there's that, and then the jagged sounds of angular, just generally angular is okay, and it doesn't have to sound all fat. Some aesthetic things like that, like deep bass and everything, just flying.
And then what about
DIY? What about recording is fine. And then the singing, some just meets like weird things you say repeated, and you play with the way you say it. You know, like how you say it is important as what you say sometimes. Although he says better things than me, but you know, he like is musical with his mouth in his way. So those were some things.
Musical,
I was like,
with his mouth.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. But then also, what about the presentation of Pavement as far as a post-fall thing, because that's struck me as being post-fall.
Yeah, some of the artwork that I started with, like on Slant Enchanted, and was definitely like fallish. I changed it, but I it was just sort of like caught in your legs a little bit, like take it or leave it, a little bit cryptic.
Cryptic for sure. Yeah, like the falls.
You don't have to understand it, but it's like there's a whole world here that you might not get, but it's you know, the world building, I guess you call it. They did that.
Sure.
Maybe unintentionally, but like for English people, it's not as odd to them, maybe, but to us it is.
Well, and going back to like what they do and sort of how why Slanted and Enchanted is such a genius term is this idea of like of, you know, looking again at things that actually Pavement, Slanted and Enchanted is so good and it's so fall like in that it's like look at that thing again, look at this thing that you take totally for granted and is sort of about the, you know, Pavement sort of implies that something's been done and gone over. You know, and for some purpose, that's kind of a bummer, and possibly, but then Pavement, Slanted and Enchanted, in the same way that like the fall stuff is like, you know, him making this fascinating world out of all this bleak shit, you know, like out of all this like harsh English reality, all of a sudden turns into this other thing. You know what I mean? That isn't necessarily joyful or fun, but it's just different. It makes you.
It's like serious, sort of just in the end it's sort of like this is a little, you know, you can take it as a joke, but it's a bit intense too. I mean, so I, you know, like we're shy people, we're not like in a Proclaim we're like the heaviest band or anything, but because we're not that confident, but you know, it's there, it's maybe you can take it like it's a game or it's like intense, you know, like that's sort of what I was striving for too. Mm. Like in bands, I like bands like Can or The Fall. It's like, this is like intense. Their music is more intense because they're like better players. Mm-hmm. But you know, like Can's a heavy band. It's like a dark band. It's
right.
Heavier than like the Beatles or even the Stones or something. There's something like, in the music that's a little bit like death or something, you know, I don't know, at times
they're definitely going somewhere. Yeah. Going somewhere beyond.
Well, it's also, I always thought of it as very mysterious too, you know, like bands you couldn't really figure out. And, you know, like I mean, people were a little confused about us from day one, you know?
Well, dude, that's the biggest thing, but go ahead, because I want to talk about that. But go on, Scott, please.
No, I just think that adds to the whole kind of picture here where, maybe a suburban kid in America hearing, you know, Slanted for the first time, they'd never heard The Fall. They'd never heard, you know, some of these bands. And they're like, well, this is different, and like, where's this coming from? And yeah, definitely added to it.
Did you have because I
what's up with SM and Spiral Stair?
Well, exactly. I gotta say, because
I still get that now. I'm like, why did you call yourself Spiral Stairs?
Because it's fucking cool as shit. What was interesting, I want to two things, Scott. Like, did you have the idea did you have an audience in mind, and was it some kid in the suburbs that you just wanted to blow their fucking mind? What was that the case? I'm obviously because
with that name.
No, just with like with this record, with this band that I have, I wanted to land to some like what ears ultimately.
I don't think I thought of that. I just was thinking. You know, as a 20, what were we, 24?
Stings you.
So it was, no, it was
more it peers. Was like, peers.
This is, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
I think we just wanted our friends to like it, and we were happy with that. Mm-hmm. And you know, I definitely knew it was good.
Right. Right.
Yeah. You know, compared to kind of what else I was listening to. But I liked, everything else was great too, but it was just like, it just, you know, being part of it is, you're like, man, this is, you know, this is cool.
I mean, like the thing that I've mentioned this to Steve, but I haven't talked to you in a while. Like, you guys do not get, and like, I'm not aware of a band that didn't have pictures or use of themselves or use their real names, you know, out in a non-residency sort of way. You know what I mean? Like where, and that was a really big and exciting thing about Pavement. I mean, and particularly about this record is like, how the fuck did this record get hit so fucking hard when it came out with not, with nobody knew what the fuck you look like or could attach, they couldn't even attach a Christian name or face to the thing. And it, you know, and like, I thought that was incredibly powerful. And, but it doesn't seem to be mentioned anymore. I don't know.
I know. And like, yeah, people don't care anymore. Yeah. Well, there's like the Swell Maps. They had cool names.
Right.
They had like Jowhead and Epic Soundtracks.
Right.
Spiral, I thought Spiral Stairs was a good name. I mean, I like Spiral Scratch record a lot. So I was like, he's Spiral Stairs.
Right, right.
I'm not answering that. Yeah, I think just went with the, it started with the cover art of the first record. So this was real, like I just made up all this mumbo jumbo on there and just made it weird. I don't know what I was really trying to, a lot of records, I mean, some records I liked back then, like Faust,
okay,
so
right,
far Faust, and stuff.
Sense.
It just had this black cover. You didn't know who these guys were. They were just like Faust. I didn't know what they looked like. And then Perubu. And I mean, I was just thinking of these artsy groups that were sort of like that. And
oh, that's right. And Perubu with Crocus Behemoth and all that shit, right? Right.
I just like, we're suburban. We're like, we're from the Cleveland of California. This is fine.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why that, how that happened. I mean, I think it was mainly, yeah, just.
Well, we didn't really think, we just thought that was going to be it.
Yeah, that's true.
Let's just
too.
Be, make
it wasn't
this,
a plan
make
to make it as... to rule the world. It was like, who cares what our names are anyway? And If it sucks, like, no one will know it was us.
Like, did that actually occur to you? What was that?
Bit. I had. I kind of am wishing that now because I did this, like, this band Super Organism asked me to do, like, a semi-rap cameo on their new record, and I think I kind of, like, didn't nail it. Like a little, but they just like are fans. I'm just worried. You know what I mean? It's not my specialty. I wasn't doing it for money or anything, but I feel right. Like I wish I could add a fake name now.
A rapper. Why don't you just get credited as use a Pavement name?
I know, right?
That would be good.
Yeah. I know.
Yeah. But then that could be on the record, and then they could say whatever they want for their press, you know, if they want to brag about heavies.
We were all planning our careers in the White House or law in corporate law. We couldn't have those.
Well, it's funny actually, kind of talking about this stuff because I feel all that with, and there was something about that made it that much more powerful. It's like, okay. Then there's this fucking record that everybody likes and nobody knows what, you know, what they look like or what their real names are. Is and are people using the real names and showing what they look like? Are they corny? You know, like there is something
I
like,
know, right? Yeah.
Pavement hit like that a little bit, you know what I mean? When it came out and
well,
like
the New York scene, like definitely like Pussy Galore, and it was all like image 1000%. They're like, who are these beautiful brown students that like
semiotics majors
these beautiful rich kids that like sing like songs anti-Semitic songs as a joke. you know,
about themselves.
Right?
Yeah. Oh God, you know, that's really interesting. In some ways, Pavement really is like an inside out pussy galore. Do you know what I mean? It's very approachable music, but you can't see what they look like. You know.
Right.
And neither band has a bass.
I went to see Pussy Galore and Davis, and I gave Neil the very first 7-inch.
Oh, you did?
No shit.
And he looked at me and he said, "I don't have a record player."
Yeah. That sounds about right.
So I was a little crushed.
Of course. That's unfortunately, whatever. We're all old and we'll date ourselves, but I still think that it's unfortunate that kids seem to have no context for which to understand what Royal Trucks meant, you know, to people who gave a shit, because there is no comparison. I don't even know how to start to explaining, other than like, you knew damn well that these guys were cooler than you and better than you.
They've offered every choice for us to like come on board, you know. They've done
reunions,
they've got signed by
Awesome
for tons of money and reintroducing it, and it just doesn't
it never lands. It's
it
so
doesn't
funny.
Land. It's really surprising to me.
I feel like it's something within I feel this way, and I'd say this with all due respect, it's some kind of thing that Neil Haggerty wants. He wants it to be this way. He just wants it to be this way. But this is interesting, because this is another thing I was thinking about, is like, this fucking Slanted and Enchanted record is this kind of monumental record, and it gave you guys fucking, I mean, both you guys have managed to be able to live certain, like, kind of like freaks for the rest of your lives, sort of artsy freaks. I mean,
yeah,
that's
that
kind of
great. That was
that's
great.
Kinda
when
crazy.
It was done, I came back to Hoboken, I played it for Bob Nastanovich and David, and they were like, "You're set, dude. get ready. People are going to like you for a while." That kind of shit. And I was like,
"That's
really?"
Amazing.
I was like, "Listen to it on a cassette." I'm like, "This is it, huh? Okay, cool." And then I was still working at the art museum, and these people were coming to do meetings with me, like John, this loader guy from Southern. So we're trying to determine the English. Who was going to put it out, and maybe Matador. I think Matador already was.
Right.
So, yeah, I remember that being, like, pretty cool. I'm like, I'm not going to have to work here, you know, like, anymore, I don't think. We're going to get to go on tour. I mean, it's all relatively small compared to, like, Nirvana coming in the future, but still huge.
I mean, huge, but again, also, but you're talking about, like you know, that the records... No pictures, no real names, because maybe, you know, take it or leave it, you know, and maybe everybody will think it sucks. But and so yeah. then I could move on with my life. But the idea that's like, no, this, you know, we're not sitting here talking about it because of like some memory lane shit, and you did all this other stuff. It's like your identities are still fairly wrapped up in this thing, both of you guys, you know, and both of you guys can go. When you get your, you know, whatever shit aligns in your lives, and go, you know, play these songs, and people get fucking psyched. And it's like, that clearly was not the intention of that record, you know, I guess that's just like one of the cool things about making something really awesome is that it doesn't, it lives, it gets this life of its own, you know.
In the early times, you know, even if it's like, fucking Motley Crue or something, still kind of interesting, where it's Guided by Voices or Motley Crue, how the I'm naturally not that interested in the Motley Crue, how it came out, but people are. You know, they like to show those pictures of them living in a shitty apartment and getting discovered.
It's like origin, you know, origin stories. Yeah.
Still, that's ours pretty much, you know, is that record. Yeah. So the other things that came were like different battles and aesthetic choices that based on that starting point for me, at least. So it was definitely when we were like, oh, we're going to go out in the world now and like people are going to see our faces. We're going to be jamming on that Reading stage.
I know. I always think about that. I mean, also, just historically, it's like, right, these fucking guys were playing. There was a sea of people. Whenever I think of a big show, weirdly, I think of a big show, in the context of somebody like me or my peers playing it, it's that fucking show. It is always that show. It's that thing with the fucking audience, you know?
Like, in England,
must have been like what the fuck, you know? But like,
very weird.
That had to be super weird, you know? I mean,
well, it was like, we were like L7 and Mudhoney. We were like bit players in the drama, but you know, we were getting there.
There's something about Slanted and Enchanted that, again, this is my take for sure, but that and the Nirvana record were somehow this thing, you know, like the Nevermind record, and like, was Slanted and Enchanted like Nevermind for snob bitches? I don't know.
We definitely had a little like, you know, they knew about us and were kind of wary a little bit.
Yeah, right.
Because Kurt Cobain was definitely, and Courtney were savvy to like, you know, they got Kim Gordon to produce their album or whatever. And about Gerard Cosley. So like they knew about it.
Right.
And wanted to, you know, be part of, accepted that way too. I'm sure you want your cake and eat it too.
It was interesting how it there was this sort of like, okay, Nirvana is loud and they're mad about stuff and they're, you know, and they're on drugs and they're and this is like resonating resonating to the world, but Pavement is also like really out of control resonating. Yeah. But not touching on those points, you know, in that way.
Yeah, we were more the sound of Young Williamsburg, you know.
I mean,
the very start of that, just the more New York sound. I mean, I make fun of Williamsburg now or whatever, but you know, it was cool then. And
you were the Williamsburg, the pre-Williamsburg, you know, because Jersey City was such a vibe, and Williamsburg used to be, you know, just to give context, like around that time of Slanted and Enchanted, I moved to Williamsburg and I got 0.0 visitors in the entire year that I lived there. I lived at the fucking foot of the Williamsburg Bridge, like on the same block as Peter Luger, right there, and no one. And I was like running around in Manhattan. I was hanging out next fish every night. No one would ever visit. No one would visit.
Scary. Maybe they would go to Domsey's or something.
Maybe. You know, but you would take the L, you know, but that's a different vibe. Like the JMC,
the fucking itch.
Yeah, like so gnar, you know, but again, so there was this, it's just kind of across the bridge, you know, and Pavement definitely had that sort of like across the bridge, you know, vibe, you know, but which is funny because you immediately became right to the center, which I guess is always what happens, you know what I mean? But it's like you went from being the outsider across the bridge to being this thing that's just like, well, Pavement is it. It's like, well, but Pavement's about not being it,
you know, like,
which had to be weird.
Well, it's weird in material terms, just when you're playing like Roseland or something. I mean, that's like really hard to do when you're like not that good and haven't played many shows. It's, you know, but people like you just for who you are, you know that, but you also hear that sound coming out of your amp and you know,
right,
it's like not like the other, you know, some like Sonic Youth or something. They built their sound over like gigging for four albums, and you're just kind of for like sure. Thrown out there.
And also, yeah, but yeah. What's interesting for sure, but there's also like, so again, this must have been strange. And I'm thinking about this now, which is that, okay, you're playing fucking, everything blows up and you're like this big band, but you're not prepared for it. But unlike other things, examples, people are showing up to see a lot of these other bands because of what they look like or what they've read about them or something to do with a cult of personality a little bit, you know, because it's rock music. There has to be that kind of image that people are buying into. You guys did not have that. People were showing up to hear the songs from this record that they've been obsessed with. You know what I mean? And that's really different, you know, like that's a different headspace. So I can imagine that just had to be strange.
We drank a lot. Yeah. I mean, everyone did back then, but we drank a lot.
I know, God, 90s was drinking was huge. I remember seeing you at Roseland and be like, how's it going? You know, because I couldn't believe you're playing Roseland. You're like, I've been smoking a lot of weed.
Both of those things. It was stressful. I'm still, you know. But now we have another tour, Matt, that's coming up with some bigger shows. So,
well,
like,
I know.
Now we're old and we can handle it. At least I can.
Right. Right. I mean,
when your dreams come true like that, it's quite quite scary. The original times. I mean, you know, from, I'm sure it doesn't even matter if you were playing First Avenue in Minneapolis and like,
for sure,
somebody's there that you think is like, you really are, think is the greatest musician or something. You're like shitting your pants.
Totally. No. And also, I mean, obviously because you're young, your imagination is wild, but still limited to what you know. And when you knock it the fuck out of the park and the world says that it's great and you're that age, like, what the fuck do you do? You know, and it's still like, what's funny for me is that my bands were always like, you know, just, they were just smaller and they weren't like earth shaking and stuff like that. And even Chavez was sort of, I think a lot of the lyrical concerns and point of view was this with that band. The Chavez thing was like, well, there's all these other bands that are huge and we're not. You know what I mean? Like
yeah,
not in a bitter way, but just like, yeah, like, huh. You know, all right. So we're doing it for some other weird reason, you know,
yeah, you didn't feel that strain, but there's a different kind of strain.
Yeah. But it's funny because, you know, like at the time, like me and Clay really liked Pavement, but when I listened to it, I'm like, God, there was a lot more sophistication going on, specifically Enchanted, Slanted and Enchanted, that I feel like I could have ripped off a little better or something like that. Yeah. Or like, I could have stolen some more shit. Like I was like, damn it, I should. I you because should again,
that, you but, could but also have so, just like been pissed off at us. And no, like a lot of bands probably were too. I accept that.
Nobody ever caught that Unreal Is Here is a take on Here by Pavement because there's that. I kind of did, but kind of didn't. And when I was listening to it, I was like, oh yeah, because there's that, the way that Here revolves around that one single note, you know, like the chords keep on, Unreal Is Here does the same exact fucking thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Where it's like the one resolve.
Cool. I'm gonna go listen to it.
Yeah, check it out. You'll see. Yeah. I was like, oh, whoa, we did. And I was like, oh, it's even called Unreal Is Here, which is kind of funny. But there really is this like such cool high level playing done in a way that's cool.
Are always
put it, you know, and it's like, I was curious, Steve, were you into the Groundhogs at this point?
No, not it's yet. Funny. That wasn't even until later, but I don't think it's so up your alley.
It's really up your that band was like meant for you because it sounds, you could hear Pavement, you could hear Slanted and Enchanted and think, and then hear Groundhogs and be like, oh yeah, I can see how this guy like that.
I mean, I'm trying to think. I would have been doing Jagged Fall things, and there were some My Bloody Valentine's first album kind of wah 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 wah. Not the one that made them famous.
Right. Isn't anything.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah.
I mean, I like how shitty that album sounded.
Yeah.
Stuff like, and some of the bent notes on that. I mean, I don't know where, I mean, Sonic Youth, a lot of the one line just going up with two notes the same. It's kind of like
I always thought
Death Valley 69 type. Or something, just that kind of thing. I remember I did that, but and a little bit of the New Zealand music, Verlaine's and the Clean.
Oh yeah, you know,
I was into that.
That tracks. That definitely tracks. Scott, what were you gonna say?
I used to always think it was we sounded like Buffalo Tom.
Really?
Yeah.
That's
which
so...
I loved them, but it had that kind of like those that they're kind of like jangly songs.
Sunflower Suit, I know that song.
Some of those songs on
that was a little bit Slanted of the dinosaur, just... like when's the dinosaur Maybe. Album coming out? There's a Buffalo Tom one. I know what you
they're
mean.
Yeah, Buffalo Tom is always in the shadow. That's funny actually. There's the Chavez song that I really liked, and everyone's like, "Oh, that sounds like a Buffalo Tom song." I was like, "What? You what the fuck?" There's some riff.
Sunflower Suit.
Bird Brain.
Oh, Bird Brain. I know that one too.
Yeah. That song's big.
That guy, Bill Janovitz, is cool.
He's nice, I think.
Yeah, he's a Stones fanatic, and I think that he's written some really interesting Stones kind of like just like I think maybe 33 1/3. He may have written a book. Yeah. I've recently read some stuff by him. I was like, this guy can write his ass off and he's qualified, you know, because he writes about
me. I've seen him on social media saying clever things. Like
he's cool.
Where he wasn't trying to be too cool type thing, like a fan.
Yeah.
So I always like people like that.
No, he's a good one for sure. Well, I was going to ask, because you mentioned this, and and to me, as far as it, because I'm not particularly a gear guy, but I think it is important to, for those people who are, what the fuck was going on with how Slanted and Enchanted was recorded? It's recorded, I take it, on what kind of tape machine?
16-track, 1-inch, with a board. I can't remember the name of the board, but it was a cool board that Gary got from his brother. It was sort of vintage. The most interesting things are that the priest, like it was tuned for like some hard rock band that had just been in there like the day before us, like a metal band or something. Gary, like the drums and whatever,
the drums
everything
were
was EQ'd. So maybe there was like one of those old fashioned death metal sort of all highs and like scooped middle, you know, like the whole thing that
the Scott Burns, the earache
better,
sound. Yeah.
For better or worse, that Morbid Angel, like Miami metal sound. Might have had
Scott Burns.
Yeah.
I did not expect to be giving Scott Burns a shout out, but he's the guy who made all those records.
He was using that settings, and then we just were like, Steve Albini said, like, no reverb, you know?
Right.
So there's going to be no reverb on anything. And I didn't know what compression was yet. So if there was compression, that was just Gary doing it, you know? Like,
right.
I didn't know how that worked.
But there is reverb
on
one
song.
Yeah, you're on the guitar, and it sounds really
cool. On here,
cool.
There's reverb on the drums, too. There might be some guitar solos with reverb, but I'm saying not on the drums. Not on the drums, except on one song. And not on the vocals.
What kind of guitars were you using?
My same Stratocaster with five strings, because it was, and a Steinberger, which
that's Gary's, the best.
Yeah, Gary's Steinberger bass and guitar, because his dad developed the molds for them. I mentioned that to you before. He's like in plastics. He had also built the World Trade Center antennas on the top. Like, he was involved in that. And so he got free Steinbergers. And Gary used to like to throw them around, like, in his mock heavy metal band called Death's Ugly Head. So they would play, and he let the other guys use them, and they'd do, like, covers of metal songs in a punk way, and they'd dress up kind of Rocky Horror style, and they'd throw their instruments, like, on the ground, like, from the stage onto the concrete, and those don't break.
No, or go out of tune.
Yeah, and so it did have a tiny chip, though. The bass did have a little tiny chip, so it's not entirely true. But that's through, like, complete abuse of the so we thought it was funny to use them.
The I can't believe it.
Yeah, the bass sounds. That's right. So it actually is for that My Bloody Valentine, like, on the song Perfume V. I'm like, wow, 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 wow. It works. That guitar really works well for that. Those Steinbergers, there's real even whammy.
Yeah.
And the bass sound, the bass that we use on the one track is the bass sound of the Steinberger on Slant Enchanted.
That is so fucking cool. I love that. I mean, yeah. Scott, you never fucking, Scott, you never told me about the Steinberger shit. That's really fucked up that you never told me that, I gotta say.
Oh,
you never.
Sorry.
Yeah. But like, Scott had like his little Mustang, I think, and
right.
What did you play the bass?
I think
on?
I had
bass guitar. Did you play?
I think that was. It was either out of the Mustang or out of the. I think I had that Tele as well, that yellow Tele.
Right. That's probably the bass sound usually, unless I'm doing.
That's probably the bass.
Well, look, I'm moving back to the Steinberger vibe, because that's. To me, there's something about, you know, Pavement is like, I think of it as like, you know, Stratocasters and somehow, you know, kind of broken old whatever things. And then when I found out that it was the fucking Steinberger sound.
It's on like 40% of the songs.
That's incredible.
The pedals, there's this orange distortion pedal that's made by Boss or something, I don't know, but all I know is that if you press down on it, I thought it was really cool, if you press down on it, it went to a feedback sound, like the same note always, though, but it would go like and I just thought that was really cool. It's on like one of those songs, it doesn't matter, like that I'm like blah, 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 one of those songs. So I used that. That's, and Scott had this really crappy Fender amp. Remember that one?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
with that was like red knobs.
Yeah.
And then I had an Epiphone amp that was actually terrible. Pretty fucking nice, that I got from this guy in town, and I got it sent to New York, and it never made it. You know, like someone either stole it off my stoop. It's like an Epiphone ER8 something. That's basically it. I don't think we had any other. Oh, I had a Rat. A Rat.
No, didn't you have the? What was the your
Microsynth?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was Gary's. Okay, so, you talked. Gary, that's used on like that was Gary's. No Life Sinister and Flamethrower, and it's original Electro-Harmonix Microsynths. They sound a lot better than the second generation of those two.
That's a guitar pedal, yeah. And so what's doing the I've got one only life to live,
that's me on keyboards. That's a DX7.
Yeah,
like we use a lot of DX7, Gary.
That's right.
I thought they were like supposed to be really uncool or something, so I used them.
Okay.
But like so, people sort of like them almost, or they're
Yeah, no, they're considered vintage gear. But so okay, so
a lot
to be
of
clear,
DX7. That's all through a distortion pedal.
Okay. All right. And was that a deliberate move? Were you aware of the, were you sort of laughing, but like, I'm going to, or not laughing, but just like, I'm going to use this DX7 because this is the most uncool thing to use in 19 or in the 90s. And then, and also was the Steinberger.
Fall used some really like rickety psychedelic keyboards, but like that's janky, all I had. Yeah. But I was like, right. I can use that.
Through a rap
smoke weed during overdubs. I smoke weed. I never smoke weed singing vocals or doing takes. But like,
were you smoking? Did you smoke weed?
Yeah,
was there weed?
Keyboard overdub okay. and mixing.
Sick.
Well, Gary sold weed, so he it was always around.
Yeah.
So Pavement, Pavement Slanted and Enchanted. There was weed involved.
Yes, on the overdubs.
On overdubs.
Keyboard things, I know, because like I can hear it when I'm doing that. I got one holy light one. I know I'm stoned because like I wouldn't
right.
make up something like that.
But like what? But there's that weird little keyboard line, which is such a cool line. It happens twice, or it happens exactly the same way. So that's a part, right? Because it's funny. I used to think of it as... Yeah.
That's like a preset. It has to be. I'm not playing any notes. It must be a preset that goes...
Okay, I got it. Right, because it sounds like a sample. That's what I was going to say, because it runs like a sample, like because it happens over and over again.
Yeah, somehow just messing around with presets and distortion pedal.
What are you going to do live when I'm sitting there waiting for that part to happen?
We have a keyboard player.
Who's playing?
Rebecca.
Oh, great.
I forget her last name.
Cool.
She's in White Rebecca Wild Cole. Flag and the
oh, cool.
She's from Portland. She's really cool. good at piano. Rinders. She's going to play like those parts.
Great.
And if we do that song,
get a DX7. Come on.
I know.
Working into the budget.
I mean, we tried to play some of these songs without Gary. They're pretty hard, like Fame Thrower and some of those old ones, because he.
Yeah.
He just plays faster than, and also we're older now. Steve's naturally a slow player with
right.
a deep groove. I like what he does, but it's not his style. Like Jake wouldn't be able to play it really either. You know, a lot of people can't.
No, he's some really. He's phenomenal. It's that lady in a bottle thing where it's like, okay, we have the weird old guy playing too many notes. It's like, no, this is actually like, it's so fucking rocking and precise in this neat way, which is the magic of records. Yeah. Cause I'm sure it didn't feel that way at the time.
No. Like, it all holds together though. If I'm playing, I mean, if you have someone playing like, the same person playing three of the five parts, it's usually me. It can also sound more together. You know what I mean? Like,
right. For sure. Of course. Yeah. Yeah.
You can kind of blend all the outer parts with the three of the one person. And then it also obviously sounding a little out of time is a great thing.
Yes. they call that the rub.
Yeah.
Steve, you had some really funny stories about misadventures in Europe. And did any of that play into any of these lyrics? Because for some reason, in my mind, there's something about Slanted and Enchanted there that I think I mentioned before, just this idea of like you're seeing things for the first time, you're young and you're kind of excited about things and you're flipping things around in your mind and stuff. Did any of your Europe travels or misadventures have anything to do with your feeling for writing?
I don't know, man.
Okay.
I mean, there's a song about Zurich and stuff.
Right.
I would have just been thinking of it being sort of an icy financial capital and...
I see.
Not anything... I couldn't even afford to travel there, probably. You know what I mean?
Right. Like,
it would have had to be, like, Syria stained or Egypt. Because, like...
So...
That's where you could live for $5 a day.
Right.
Not much. I think
okay.
It's hard to say I got back. I mean, I would have been more just in the art gallery, talking to Berman.
New York.
Writing down shit, trying to be cool. You know,
right.
Like, what's going to be cool?
So it's very New York.
Who is
so
this guy? It's going to be a good. That's going to like not be an idiot singing.
It's New York. But it's a New York record. I mean, like,
pretty
slanted.
Much. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Do it in stock. There's always going to be the Valley. The later we did one after that called Watery Domestic, where I really like tried to hone in on some Stockton like Valley feels with the lyrics. But yeah, I mean, there's always going to be that Stockton chip on your shoulder. Like it's a nice, it's really, you know, it's nice to be, to not be from like LA or I mean, obviously someone from Compton is going to say they're going to disagree or something, but we like Stockton, we are the Murder Valley. We're like,
oh yeah,
we're gritty. And of course I'm like a bougie dude or whatever, but like, at least I'm from Stockton, you know, it's like I can compared to like real Stockton, you know, I'm like I play tennis and could afford a piano lesson or something. So like, I'm not like some tough guy, but you know, still, I know what it feels like there. And I think it can rub off like recording in Gary's shitty suburban studio and smoking like dirt weed and shitty beer. It rubs off on the record.
Skies won't sink my soul. I've dreamt of this, but it never comes. But it never comes. The horizon! The nature's dry.
Let me see if I have anything else in my notes that we need to. All right, why did you call the song "Our Singer"?
That's a good question. Let me see. Yeah. There is a reason. Our Singer must be another song, but I can't remember what it is right now. I have to get back to you on that. I was trying to, you know, it's a little bit a last moment song. The tape runs out.
Right.
Me and the drummer, and it has a little bit of a hint of Hip Priest.
Mm-hmm. The Fall. Yes. Yeah, yeah.
But,
for sure. For
you know, it's happier and not happier. It's a little more melodic.
It's not as spooky. It's not as like dark and terrifying as
it Hip was
Priest.
Like crank out a once more song.
Right.
And I like that feeling. The reason I kept it was it's sort of, you know, just throwing one last song off on the end.
Yeah, it's like
minimal, not much, just a guitarist and a singer. Maybe that's why.
And then was there who did you have in mind for Loretta Scars? Was there a Loretta?
No, that would have been, you know, like the Velvets. It's always like somebody's name.
Name, yeah, yeah.
Really, you know, like I'm also one of these people that the album VU was actually very important. For the 80s.
Same.
That came out and I was like learning those songs. Those were just as big to me as... Well, they weren't as big as the first album, but they were bigger than the third. You know, like the third was, I didn't really know that album as well back then.
I couldn't find any other fucking
Or not the third, the fourth. The fourth one, I mean. Loaded. I wasn't into that in the 80s.
Well, like I just couldn't find any Velvets records. Then VU and another VU came out, and those were the easiest ones to get. So I VU was the first thing that I heard by then. You know, like
same here. And I was like, that's what I was learning. I was like, there's lots of songs with like girls' names and That's what you got to do. And I know he had Candy Says before and others, but like, I was just like, oh, that's Lisa, Candy, Loretta.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Yeah. Oh, gotcha. 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 Is She's My Best Friend on View?
Yes.
On another
View? I was really into that song.
That is the best fucking song. What I request that Pavement cover that song for this tour.
I know the chords. I learned all those songs. Like
I learned
with a guitar.
I'll send you. I just did it. I actually learned it and did it for this thing to raise money for Anthology Film Archive.
That's a great song to cover.
Yeah, and I realized that it's about Lou Reed's sister, because he has a couple of rad songs that I'm certain are about his sister, like Little Sister, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, but if you listen to She's My Best Friend, think about it from that he's talking about his sister, and it makes an amazing song even better. Yeah, it's really cool.
When he says like electricity comes from other planets.
Oh, the best.
I'm just like so into
huge,
that, you know,
massive. Yeah,
and they're
massive.
Fucking around. They're all like, doo, 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 just having a good time. I was like, I want to have that good time feel on some song without it being artificial. You know,
right? Is that where the Pavement doo doos come from?
Yeah, some do.
That's cool. That's cool. Yeah. That's awesome.
It's a big album to me.
I don't talk
about it much because I forgot too, you know, because like so many other things come in your life, but certain things are like there when you're like 19 to 21 and they are important.
Well, man, I'm psyched to see you guys and I'm glad we got to do
man.
This.
Likewise.
Big love to you and I'll see you guys when
you're seeing
I'll
you.
See
you.
Hell yeah. Good seeing you. I'll see y'all soon.
Okay.
Bye, okay. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye guys.
Bye.
Trizzy.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks. I can't seem to leave. Oh, wait. No, I'm here and I'm still trying to leave. Okay.